Thank you very much, okay? Now I've got the power. All right, okay. And it is the longest pastoral letter, I think, in the New Testament, where Paul is actually engaging the minds of people, the congregation. Some of the issues have been written, they've written about. Other issues are issues that Paul has learnt about. And as a pastor, as well as a teacher, I'm very interested to learn something about pastoral method. How do you deal with particular issues? And so I began, first of all, by looking from, I think it was P46, the manuscript, one of the early manuscripts, of how many lines were devoted to individual issues. I did that partly because, as you know, nomina sacra, the divine names, are put in abbreviation. All the letters are joined together. Of course, there's no spaces, all in capitals. It gets us some idea of how much space Paul devotes to each particular issue. And then I also did a word count in a moment of madness in terms of the number of Greek words that are used to deal with this. Now, I'm just trying to get some idea of the amount of space that Paul had to devote to particular issues, trying to work out how long it took him to actually argue his case. And what surprised me to some extent was that that most of the moral issues could be dealt with quickly. Some what I call cultural issues took much longer. And that was a fascination. So I began by asking myself, in a Roman colony, and this was a Roman colony very much, although they wrote in Greek, it was very much committed to what we call Romanization, that there were two issues in Roman culture. One was the question of conflict. It was a culture of great conflict. It was a class culture, but given to great tensions in relationships. And the third was it was a colony that had lots of conformity. In the Roman culture, you really had to conform to the requirements of your class and what was required in the culture. Roman culture was underlined by Roman law to a remarkable extent, Roman civilization. We know of no subsequent civilization where so much was legislated for and so much was determined by law. So the issue of conforming to that was really part of Roman culture, and the other was a question of conflict, the conflicts that went on. So I examined the letter on this basis, and I came to the view that this letter is taken up with issues of conflicts and compromises on the part of Christians. Any conforming society where you have people who are countercultural, they have to work out how they're going to handle some of these issues. Either you oppose them or you compromise with them. So this is just one of the experiments, and you're all guinea pigs this afternoon, in which I want to sort of look at this letter and work out one or two things. One is Paul's strategy for resolving. I wrote a book called The Influence of Secular Ethics and Social Change. The book I'm writing subsequently is How Does Paul Resolve These Issues? Because that's what pastoral ministry is about. How do you resolve the problems that are presented by Christians in the difficulties of life? Now, Ben Withington wrote a book in which he simply said that this is a rhetorical letter. You begin with an introduction, you have various things dealt with, and you come to a conclusion. That doesn't get us very far at all. Because if we look at Paul's argumentation, he argues every case differently. There is no sort of pastoral way of handling all these problems. It's all the same. So there is a different strategy that Paul has adopted in each case. Sometimes he asks 7 or 8 questions, the resolution of an issue. Other time you wonder where he's going because it takes a long time for him to do this. And so I'm fascinated from the point of view as a pastor what I can learn. And more than that, I think there are some surprises for us. That Paul seems to deal with individual issues as they have arisen, but the underlying causes he seems to wait until the end. And that's a very interesting strategy to adopt. Now, I'll explain that, because it's not the way that anyone has ever written a commentary on 1 Corinthians, and it's unusual, but it's right. I'm joking, okay. But I am interested, because I deal with people with pastoral problems, and how do we handle things? How do we handle issues that are cultural issues and persuade people that these cultural issues really have to be evaluated because they are counterproductive in terms of relationships and cause difficulties? And other issues, how do we deal with some of the moral problems that people deal with? So I did my word count, and as you can see on the first page, that I came to the conclusion that about 46% of the issues in 1 Corinthians are devoted to resolving problems concerning conflict among Christians. That's a very large percentage by our thinking, but it's not really in terms of Roman society. Because in Roman society, if you had a fight with someone at a dinner party, that would end up becoming a point of vexatious litigation because you had lost face. The person had humiliated you. So you go to court and you engage on a vexatious matter, a small issue. You actually are there to defeat your opponent publicly because of his humiliation of you. So civil litigation, which didn't come under the governor, criminal litigation, civil litigation, you resolve these issues by going to court, and the person, the jury, had to vote on the grounds of who was the most senior in terms of status. You could come from the same class. The jury had to vote on that, and then you were fined if you lost the case. And of course we've got something about that, about brother going to brother. This is unbelievable on the smallest matter. So that's one of the interesting things about how people resolve conflict. The other way in which they, or didn't resolve it, how they settled their scores, but it didn't resolve the issue. One of the other interests that we have in terms of that the associations of the first century, and remember the early church would have been seen as an association. That is the judgment of Gallio, that this is not an illegal group. And the associations were notorious for conflicts and politics and this party and that party. And then between households, if people belonged in a particular household, there could be conflict if you were not in the same administrative group, the tribal group. So it was a society, you know, where people were always fighting. And there was always this sort of tension going on. And the fact that it's risen up in the church does not surprise me at all. And also the fact that because it was a society of conflict, wherever the Christians met, the conflict seemed to raise its head over teachers, over the issue of the courts, at the Lord's Supper, in terms of the 1 Corinthians 12 to 14. So wherever these Christians were in conflict relationships, wherever they met, the conflict comes out. It isn't as if they went into church, they all went and became holy, and they walked into church and everything was wonderful. So the aspects of Roman culture, because remember, these people were programmed by the culture before they became Christians, as we all are. And after they became Christians, didn't mean to say that they automatically abandoned all the secular ways of operating. And certainly as the church life evolved, people went back to old ways of operating when they came to questions of disagreement. It happens the same in our contemporary culture. How do English people fight when they have a disagreement? Well, they have a certain way of doing it. It may be polite on the outside, but there's a certain way of engaging in conflict and those things. And every culture is the same. So what we have in the Corinthian church is the fact that there is where there is a conflict situation going on, every point it shows its head in terms of the church situation. The other thing we find is that the Corinthians were not more over sex than anyone else, because what is happening here is not untypical of what happens in the ordinary aspects of Roman culture. Young men, when they were 18, they took the toga virilis, and they could have as much eating, drinking, and sex as they wanted to. It was quite acceptable. And when men married, they continued being unfaithful to their wives. For a woman, it was a criminal offence to be caught in adultery, but for a man, it was simply okay. And the wife, in the Republican time, we have a great statement that if my wife commits adultery, I can kill her, but if I commit adultery, I'm untouchable. One of the ancient authors wrote like that. Now, it had been changed under Augustus because he had moved adultery out of the privacy of the home into the criminal case, and women were not killed, but they were divorced. So they continued to behave like that. And when the feasts came, the major feasts came to the city, the travelling brothels came. And therefore, you've got people sitting down to eat and drink and rising up to play in the Corinthian situation, and they're not just playing softball or American football or something else, okay? We know what they're playing at. So that is the nature of Roman culture. It's not just typical. The story that there were 1,000 prostitutes up on the hill, if ever you climbed there, you realize, you wonder how ever they did anything when they got to the top. It's incredibly steep. But the actual imperial cult, or the temple to Aphrodite, who's now she is a very famous person. She's got clothes on. She's the lady who is the patron of the city of Corinth. And it's a very small temple. You can't swing a cat in it, but you can go up there. And there was no such thing as the business of 1,000 prostitutes on the hill at that time. But I didn't mean to say that the Roman society was not a society where people were not sexually promiscuous. So this is my fascination. This is sort of, in one sense, what is happening in Corinth. If you're a social historian and read this document through, you would say to yourself, well, what's happening here is not terribly different from Roman culture. Here are people who are just going back to cultural norms in the way they are operating, because this is the way that they've operated since the year dot, that they were that small. As they grew up, they were programmed by the culture, and they continue to behave as culture Christians. Now, how does Paul resolve the issues? That is, to me, one of the very interesting things. Why does he spend so much time on certain issues? And then why is it that he can deal with other issues much more quickly? Yes?
Why do you have a resurrection under sexual issues?
Well, that's a very good question, as the Americans say, to which I can give a very good answer. Okay? I smile when I say that, okay? Because the issues that the Corinthians of immorality have to do with their view of the body. And what are the first set of injunctions given in chapter 15? The first set of injunctions are, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Wake up out of drunkenness. Do not go on sinning. Some do not have the knowledge of God. Bad company corrupts good morals is from the Menander Thrace about a prostitute. And so it seems to me that 1 Corinthians 15 is as much about the insurrection of the body as it is the resurrection of the body. Okay? Because if you ask yourself, what are the first set of injunctions that are given, we must be able to look at the passage in the light of the ethical implications that have been argued for. So I want to argue at this point, and I'll come on a bit further, that this is about the insurrection of the body and the resurrection of the body, the deeds done in the body. And therefore, Paul is concerned that they are indulging in activities, and he therefore commands them to stop. And at the end of it, he says, with the use of the word hostia, which he uses for the conclusion of chapter 11, chapter 14, and chapter 15, the concluding remarks with the injunctions, be steadfast, immovable, abounding, always abounding in the work of the Lord. And these guys have not been abounding in the work of the Lord, because Paul says some don't have the knowledge of God, and I say this to your shame. But Paul has busted himself at the end of verses 10 and 11 of chapter 15. Paul has gone to great lengths to bring the gospel to these people, and they've turned into Christian playboys. So what I'm saying, what I want to argue is that Paul deals with the immediate symptom, the problem. But it's not until the end of the letter that he deals with the underlying cause of the issue, and that is their view of the body. He deals with immediate problems as they present themselves, but he is aware that there is an ingrained cultural view about the body, and therefore he feels that he must demolish that fully. He must pull down all those arguments. He must, as it were, demolish this citadel which has not been removed from the Corinthian thinking. Now that's one of the, I think, one of the interesting pastoral techniques of Paul, that he will deal with issues, but then at the end, he actually tackles what is the underlying cause in terms of this problem. It is the attitude to the body. Now, you and I read 1 Corinthians 15. It's about the proof of the resurrection. Shows this evangelicals are correct. We put a tick on the wall. But we have to account for everything in the issue and ask ourselves, see, they all believed in the immortality of the soul. Everyone believed that in the first century, except the Sadducees. Everyone believed the soul would go marching on like John Brown's body. But what they did not believe was in the resurrection of the body. Because the idea of the resurrection of the body seemed to be off the planet. And the New Testament's concerned about the resurrection of the body because the deeds done in the body, 2 Corinthians 4, that we shall all appear before the judgment seat to receive the good or the evil done in the body. Revelation, blessed are those who die in the Lord, they rest in their labors, and their works follow with them. So this idea of the resurrection of the body and the deeds done in the body is a very central thing in Paul's thinking, but not in the Corinthians. They've got their eternal insurance policy, called the death of Christ. They're living how they want to at the present time, and they don't believe that God will ever hold them accountable for what they have done as Christians. That's their error. It's an error also in contemporary Christianity. So the idea of that they must always abound in the work of the Lord rather than being part of the guys who are the partying set, eating, drinking, having sex. That's first century culture. And what are they doing here? Some are drunk, and in verse, wake out of drunkenness, verse 34, bad company corrupts good morals. Paul says, I have to die every day. And more than that, Paul says he had to fight the beast at Ephesus, according to the figurative way of speaking. That has to do with sexual passion. So there are some very interesting things in this section. So my argument is the first part is taken up with the that the fact that Christ has been raised also indicates that we will be raised. But how we live in the body is a matter of great importance. And the second part is, what sort of body is it, they say? And Paul says, you're absolutely stupid asking that question. He goes on to argue, but he draws the conclusion at the end that you have to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. And what are these guys doing? They're abounding in their own playboy activities. And that's why it seems to me that we have misjudged, in my thinking, part of the purpose of 1 Corinthians 15. Now, I know I go against all the commentators, but that doesn't matter. Read the text and explain why Paul says those things. Whereas he went to extraordinary lengths to bring the gospel, and now they're living off Paul's strenuous endeavours, living like playboys, enjoying a Mediterranean holiday with an eternal insurance policy, and that's how they're going to live. And Paul says, no, 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 you can't do that. And how they have been living, it shows itself in certain parts of their immoral conduct. And it says two things. Paul deals with media problems, but you have to deal with the underlying cultural problem. So that's one of the it's one of my views on the issue, the second part of this, on the compromise, where they are sexually compromised by things they're doing, and therefore Paul is concerned to deal with this major issue. It's like, as I mentioned, in the Singapore context, the view that that God is there to minimize my bad luck, maximize my good luck. If I see examples of that, I'm going to deal with that immediate issue. But I also recognize that I must deal with the underlying issue. Or I must get married this day because, well, this is the day we want to. But I also know that they have been to see the Shen spirit about the auspicious day to get married. So I have to deal with the whole question of the doctrine of God at that point and the doctrine of his goodness. Even though I'm going to deal with the symptom that is there, but I haven't dealt with the underlying cause. Now, that's what I think is happening in 1 Corinthians. Paul is dealing with the underlying cause of the immorality that exists. He's arguing each case, there's no doubt about that. But it's not just sufficient to deal with the pastoral case, we must deal with, as it were, the culturally entrenched view that needs to be demolished. Now, I know this is surprising, and you either go to sleep or you're wide awake. What is Bruce Winter up to? So let's just look at, say, the second part, and we'll deal with the first part of the question of how do you resolve conflict in a conflict society? Okay? We have the issue of incest, which under Roman law was a criminal offence. We have fornication, which was a spectator sport in 1 Corinthians 6, 12 to 20. We have issues to deal with marriage and betrothal, and some of the complications there. We also have rising up to play, in which Paul takes chapter 8, verse 1 through to 11:1, a very long discussion about the food offered to idols and the immorality attached to that. The issue of the promiscuous woman, the veiling of the married woman. The removal of a veil was a sign you're walking out of marriage, and the married woman who didn't wear a veil was someone who was a convicted adulteress and could not ever wear the marriage veil again. Okay. So here are issues that Paul is having to deal with. Now, how does he deal with those? Incest normally meant that you would be exiled from the community under Roman law and lose your citizenship. But no one has taken a case against this son who is having his father's stepmother or something. Okay? And your translation probably says that this is the kind of behavior not even among the pagans. There's no verb in the Greek for that. It's a sort of immorality that's not tolerated even among the pagans. Okay? So Paul is going to deal with this issue. And what does he require? He requires that the church exile the person from the community. For what reason? So that they may be saved in the day of judgment. Okay? The destruction of the body, but to be saved in the day of judgment. And then he goes on to talk about the fact that they're boasting about this person. And Paul is saying, you're happy to judge the outsider, but you're not prepared to judge the insider. And Paul passes judgment. Okay? So in Roman law, if you were married to someone and there was a close affinity, Roman law could tolerate that. But if you were actually involved in a relationship where the father was, the man was alive, and the son is involved with a stepmother or something like that, that was an intolerable issue and it was a criminal offence under Roman law. Okay? So Paul is having to deal with this in terms of exclusion from the covenant. Because just as incest excluded you from the Old Testament covenant, so it is it excludes you in the New Testament. God has not changed his standards of exclusion. But the exclusion here is from the believing community so that the person may be saved in the day of judgment. Yes.
It says, deliver this man to see the destruction of the flesh,
mm-hmm.
the spirit may be saved.
Mm-hmm.
How does that relate to chapter 15, where there's the emphasis on?
Well, the judgment of God, Paul sees in the Lord's Supper as people being carried out in a coffin in some cases. And here I presume it is that he may be removed probably from the earth. Okay? Perhaps that's the discussion. I don't think that his flesh is going to melt away. I'm not quite certain. Okay? We just don't know the details of what that means. So there is an exclusion issue from the community. We come then to the question of the lawsuits that Paul hears about, because these are things reported. And the case of the lawsuits going to court, Paul asks, I think, about 7 or 8 questions on the issue. Under Roman law, you could never take your family to court. Brother could not go against brother in litigation. And one of Paul's arguments here, of course, is this is intolerable in the family of God that brother should go to brother over the court issue, and it's just on the smallest matter. This is a way of settling the disputes. But Paul has argued his case by simply asking a set of questions, penetrating questions in regard to the Corinthians. Look, they're all questions, at least in my translation. And so that is how Paul deals with this issue here. So that is something in which they are working out the conflicts. The next issue is the young men engaging in the unholy trinity of eating, drinking, and sexual immorality. It wasn't to do with brothels. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach's for food. You had the dinner party. You had your companion for the evening. You lay on the couch there, and you had the food, and you had the drink. And then at the end of that, you had what was politely called after dinners. And I won't explain what went on, but you don't need much imagination to know what is going on there. And so here, in this case, Paul produces arguments against why it is that fornication damages your health and is not satisfactory. The Christian cannot engage in fornication, even though everyone else is doing it. And there are 7 reasons why you should not from this passage that Paul provides. They have to do with the doctrine of the nature of the Christian life, being joined to Christ. They have to do with the nature of the doctrine of one flesh, that sexuality, fornication puts you into one flesh relationship with someone. This is unacceptable. It has to do with the business about the doctrine of who am I in relationship to Christ and that I'm not my own to take my body where I want to. I've been bought with a price and I must glorify God in my body. So there Paul is dealing with that issue of one of the sexual issues in which the person felt everything is lawful for me. That is a standard statement in the first century. It was a catch cry. Panto excessin, everything is lawful. In other words, now I've got the toga virilis, now I'm grown up, now I'm wearing this toga, it means that I can live how I want to. And I can engage in sexual immorality, there is no problem. That's what every other young man did in Corinth, and why shouldn't the Christians? That's the question that they've asked. But Paul says, but he says emphatically, they say all things are lawful, but not everything is helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not it. But I will. But sexual immorality enslaves people; they become addicted to it. And that was one of the problems in the ancient world. So there, Paul gives a set of arguments as to why it is that this is not a spectator sport. It's not a matter of indifference. The deed's done in the body. Everyone else is doing it. It's not a good enough argument. And therefore, Paul is arguing the case. And he has proceeded with it what I call a sort of a theological construct in 6, 9 to 11. And he makes it very clear, do not be deceived, he says. There's a big warning put across the bow, do not be deceived, that those who could do certain things will have no inheritance in the kingdom. He then goes on to say, that was what you once were, but now you're different. You've been washed, sanctified, justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and the Spirit of our God. So Paul gives an explanation. What they once were is a theological construct. That if they were deceived to think that they can keep on living like this. He then goes on to say the work of Christ, both the work of the Spirit and Christ in salvation, one of the few places where it's put together, the two things together there. And then he goes on to produce a set of arguments why it is that it's wrong for young men to fornicate. Now that's a very interesting strategy, okay, if you think about it. Seven reasons why it is it's wrong for Christians to do this. Paul just doesn't simply say pastorally, if you do these things, you'll go to hell. No, he indicates that there'll be no place in the kingdom of God for people who are like that. The work of Christ has been undertaken. These are the reasons why you must not. And I presume if young men persisted in doing these things, God would bring his disciplining hand upon their lives. So it's just not sufficient to say Christians don't fornicate, you know, don't smoke, don't drink, don't chew, and sleep with women who do, sort of things. Southern piety if you come from the south in America. Okay. So here we've got an issue where Paul is providing a statement that provides it were sort of a theological understanding about Christian conduct in the kingdom, and not to be deceived by that. So what I see happening here on the question as we go through on all these issues up to the veiling of women, they all have to do with immorality on the part of, or the indifference to immorality on the part of Christians, or the issue of marriage, which is a very important issue that Paul is going to deal with. Now, I know you all look a bit stunned by what I've said, but what I'm interested in, the way in which Paul seemed to have structured the letter and the sort of issues he's dealing with. But it's not, I said, until the end of chapter 15 that he's going to deal with the question of what cultural endorsement and what underlying view is there in the psyche of the Corinthians that enables them to behave in the way they're behaving. And that seems to me to be a question we haven't asked. When it comes to the question of marriage, because of immoralities, Paul says in chapter 7, we're not quite sure what they've written about. It's good for a man not to touch his wife. Is that what they've written? You don't use the personal pronoun necessarily in Greek talking about your wife. So when I talk about my wife, I call her woman as a joke, which she doesn't think it's over funny sometimes. But in the Greek, you didn't necessarily use the word my wife. But is it talking about the fact that it's good for a man not to engage in sexual intercourse with a woman or with a wife? Well, Paul goes on, whatever's being said there, he says, because of sexual immoralities, every man must have his own wife. And the astonishing statement that Paul makes against husbands here is that the wife does not have authority over her own body, and more importantly, the husband doesn't have authority over his body to take it where he wants. Now again, Paul is challenging the idea that if you're a married guy, you can have sexual intercourse with your wife, but also, if you go off to a party or you do something else, it's okay to do it. That was part of the culture for men, for married men. They were immoral before they were, they're immoral afterwards. And there's really basically nothing the woman could do except walk out of marriage, which of course a woman could do overnight and demand her dowry back. So here is a situation where Paul is having to deal with the questions they've asked. And he says that sexual intercourse is an essential part of marriage. Don't deprive one another except by agreement for a limited time for the purpose of prayer, and come together because Satan watches the marriage bed. and he recognized when things are not happening in the marriage situation. So that is how Paul deals with the question they've raised. He then goes on to deal now with a number of other issues about the question of singleness, about the question of the married person, and the person who has an unbelieving wife. So Paul deals with those sorts of issues there. He talks about the issue of calling, and then he goes on to deal with the question of engagement. What happens in that situation? And he gives his ruling that should you marry, when should you marry this woman? Well, he puts the criteria there in verses 36 and 37. Okay? But it's still dealing with issues to do with sexuality and marriage and cultural issues that people have in their mind. The young man's behaved inappropriately towards his fiancée. He's full of sexual passion. It's bound to happen. And therefore, Paul says, in that case, they should marry. But the person who keeps his fiancée, then it's a good thing that they don't marry at this stage. Why? Because in verse 26, because of the present dislocation, the present distress. Okay? So it seems to me to be very sensible advice that's given at that point. And Paul goes on to put certain structures in the argument that he produces there. So we come to the end of chapter 7, and he also comments on the widows. And we move to chapter 8, where the Corinthians are doing with things in verse 8 on the grounds of their rights. Okay, I've got the wrong verse there. It's a different translation. So here we have a situation where people are going to eat in the idol temple as a matter of right, their rights, and Paul then produces a number of arguments why it is that Christians cannot operate on the grounds of rights. They have to operate on the grounds of the concern for the weaker brother, end of chapter 8. 9, 12, they have to business about their conduct. They must do nothing that will cause the gospel to stumble. Okay. He then goes on to talk about the fact of becoming all things to all men, and that he himself has to discipline his own body, lest having preached to others he become a castaway. He gives the example in chapter 10 of what happened in Israel. And remember, chapter 10, verse 1 should have, "For I want you to know," because it's got a connection to the previous discussion in the Greek. "I want you to know," he says. And he gives the example of what happened in the Old Testament, and the God who passed judgment in the Old Testament is the God who will pass judgment on the same issues in the New Testament. That's not the view they have, but it's certainly the view of the reality. They sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. And what happened to some of these people? Well, they were in trouble. So Paul says these things happen as an example. Do not be an idolater in verse 7. Do not engage in immorality, verse 8. Do not test God to think that you can get away with it because you got your policy. Do not engage in the grumbling against the sovereignty of God. And if anyone is confident he stands, he can take heed lest he fall. Therefore flee idolatry. And so Paul is saying that what happened, and that's why he disciplines his body, because even though an apostle, he knows that if he engages in sinful activity, God's judgment in some way will come upon his life. And so that's why he says that I discipline my body and keep it under control, that having preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. For I want you to know, brothers, what happened in the Old Testament. People change, but God don't change at all. If you know the children's chorus, you probably don't. And my grandson sings it all the time. And then he goes on to talk about the fact, well, they say everything is permitted, everything is lawful for me to do, but Paul goes on to argue. And the final statement he makes, which is an embarrassment to us all these days, is that I give no offense to Jew or Greek or the church of God, just as I try to please everyone and everything, not seeking my own advantage, the advantage of the many that they may be saved. Imitate me. I imitate Christ. So here are people who live their lives on the grounds of rights, because certain people were given the right to dine in the temple for particular festivals, a free food. an enormous festival, banquet they could go to, plus the after-dinner entertainment with the travelling brothels, sitting down to eat and drink and rising up to play. Okay? So what happens? Paul says the Christian doesn't live like that. It's important that we should recognise that our responsibility is not to be self-indulgent and work on the grounds of our rights, but because we're Christians, every Christian has an obligation to disadvantage himself in order that others may be saved. Imitate me, because that's what Jesus did, that's what I do, that's what you must do as a church. Okay? Which I think is sort of fairly straightforward. So Paul here has dealt with that issue, and then if you were here at one of the sessions yesterday about women removing their veil is a matter of contention. Under Roman law, the woman did that if she was convicted of adultery. She couldn't wear the marriage veil ever again. She had her hair cropped, and she was publicly punished and humiliated. And that's what's happening in the culture with the new women's movement, the liberation movement of the first century amongst married women, that they're removing the marriage veil, and the woman is doing this to be contentious in the church. And Paul is saying, I'm sorry, that's not acceptable for people to operate like that. So it seems to me in this passage that all these issues have to deal with cultural programming and cultural attitudes, and their attitudes to do with the body. Okay? So can we turn now... Are there any questions people want to ask on this? I admit that I have done all the talking on this. Any questions people want to ask to this point? Because some of you look very puzzled. Yes?
Just a thing. With the sort of expelling the immoral brother in a lot of, like, say, the church and the church I've been involved with, we haven't really done that sort of thing, taking a more sort of inclusive attitude towards it, because, like, you know, all have sinned and fallen short type thing, so who are we to say that you've sinned more type thing?
In a case of incest?
Not actually in a case of incest, no. But okay. Other sort of, I suppose, sexual issues as well. Some people have said, oh, they shouldn't be involved with that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, well, what does Paul do for the single men? He doesn't exclude them, but he gives the reasons why they should not do it. I presume if they persisted, they could expect God to bring some judgment. Okay. Yeah, so that's the question. And on the marriage issue about divorce and everything, Paul is giving some indications as to how that matter should be handled. Yeah. But there's a reluctance to deal with the issue, even to judge, to pass... But it's interesting, Paul says in chapter 5 that the church's task is to judge the insider, not the outsider. And we're very good at judging the outsider, but very poor at making judgment on the insider, because it's too difficult, too embarrassing. Yeah. Okay.
Paul makes such an emphasis on being in Christ in many places, in the same passage where he says turning someone over to Satan. Would you think that would be putting someone outside of Christ, or would they still remain in Christ but under Satan's...
I don't know, because I haven't got the inside information. I don't know. All I know is that so that they may be saved in the day of judgment, that all of God's judgment is remedial. But my word, the remedy is a very severe one. I think that's all one can say on that issue. It's a very severe one. But to be excluded from a group of people is a terrible humiliation in the first century. Pushed outside, that is an awful thing that happened to you. And to be excluded from a city and lose your property rights and your citizenship was awful. To be exiled to an island, that was just the ends of the earth. The total humiliation. And Paul indicates that they must do this because it will actually has an effect on the congregation. In other words, if sexual issues are not dealt with, they tend to multiply in the congregation of believing people. And there are plenty of good examples of that happening. She is not dealt with. Yeah.
I guess it's in the church where I come from, which is in a very different culture to Polynesian culture. We have several young, I can't really call them couples, but young people who have babies, and they come to church and they just continue to live together. I assume that they have been spoken to, of course, some are children of pastors. but it's a big question: shall they be asked not to come to church, or shall they be accepted? What if they want to take part in the communion? Obviously, they shouldn't. Mm. It's a big issue. People are the parents are afraid to speak to their children, and they say, "Then we lose them altogether."
Mm. So, what do you think they should do?
Well, if they were my children, and I'm also in leadership, I've spoken to the parents that they should speak with them. But it's very, very difficult. I ask them not to come. I would say not to take part in the communion.
Mm-hmm.
And get married now, because they already have children.
Yeah.
You can't force them.
So what do you think is the underlying cause in the society that they just simply live together?
It's a culture, it's a very, it's a modern spirit now that people live together,
mm-hmm.
but it's also in the Polynesian Maori and probably other Polynesians, the cultural thing that they didn't get married until they had children.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was the custom, I've been told. They wanted to see first if the woman could have children, mm-hmm. otherwise they wouldn't get married.
Mm-hmm.
But they had been the Christian missionaries, and they've been Christian since 1823.
Mm-hmm.
Still very new.
That's not terribly new.
No.
No. Okay. So, okay, let me just ask this question. How would you deal with this if you're the pastor of the church?
It sounds like the ultimate. The reason is that you're not married until you've got children.
So some of them, but it's so also the new spirit, the new age spirit coming in that people now just simply live together, as many do.
So the purpose of marriage is not to have sex. Not to have children. The purpose of marriage, according to 1 Corinthians 7, is that there should be the body of each person surrendered to each other in the sexual part of marriage. And also the fact is that God's plan is that you leave father and mother and cleave and become one flesh. Genesis 2 is very clear on that issue. So you've got there to deal with a cultural issue, you've got there to deal with a modern issue, and the biblical text, it seems to me, is sort of quite clear on this issue. And what would you do if you're the pastor?
Can I ask, are they considered married by the government?
There is no difference there. You don't have the civil marriage and then the pastoral marriage. The pastors can do the civil marriage,
mm-hmm.
perform the civil marriage. What you do if the pastor is the father of these children, of these young people.
Mm. Well, see, someone said to me, what would happen if at a challenging discussion at a marriage where someone said, oh, this man's the minister, and they said, we're living together. That was the question. and it was said very defiantly. And I said, what did your parents say when you decided to live together? Well, they were rather embarrassed because they really hadn't talked to their parents. And they said, what would happen if your son did this? I said, I want to ask him why he didn't love the woman enough to want to commit himself to her for the rest of her life. And that caused a very interesting discussion in which he said if his wife fell out of love with him, that wouldn't matter. And she was ready to kill him by the end of the whole discussion. It was very interesting. But then it would come back to the issue, wouldn't it, of Christian marriage. It is that if God establishes a covenant with us to give us security and significance and certainty, then the purpose of marriage is to reflect that. And the Bible reflects the covenant relationship there. So it seems to me you've got a cultural issue, modern issue, a lack of biblical understanding about the nature of marriage is not just to have children. The culture there is winning over Christianity. And then the issue about marriage isn't just to have children, because 1 Corinthians says that issue that they must come together. That's the nature of marriage, not just children, which is Catholic teaching, as you know, at one time. But no, the biblical teaching is quite clear. And therefore, you have to ask the question, well, why don't you love each other enough? Because when my son said to me, I'm going to get married, I said, that means, he said, I'm getting married. I said, that's good. That means you want to live with this girl for the rest of your life. And he said, that's a ridiculous question to ask. I said, no, it's a very sensible question. It's the question you ask on the marriage day. Will you have this woman to be your lawful wedded wife for the rest of time that you live together and be faithful to her? And that gives her security and significance in the relationship. And the woman also gives the husband security and significance. That's the nature of covenant. So, I mean, I think that's sort of interesting, and even from Corinthians, because Paul says that people have sex together, they become one flesh. So the business of the one flesh relationship, it cannot be made contingent. We have one flesh. If she's not fertile or he is not sufficient sperm to produce children, then we go somewhere else. That's not the nature, and therefore you can see that there's a lack of teaching at that point to tackle that issue, because that issue should have been tackled back in 1820, seems to me, and in an ongoing way in the pastoral situation, because that, I think, is how one would want to resolve it. So you tackle, you've got the theological thing, you've got the cultural thing, you've got the modern thing going on, and now you've got the sort of, the as it were, the theological, biblical statement there. And therefore, it seems to me that's an appropriate way to tackle that issue. Why don't you love her enough that you want to live with her for the rest of your life? If you do, then to turn around and say, okay, well then why not give each other security? Because the thing about people who live together is the insecurity of the relationship. Okay?
I think that's not true anymore. At least I've talked to people, because I also know about this issue, and I don't know how to discuss with people that issue. Because they say, we have promised each other that we will stay together for the rest of our lives, and we have left our parents, so we have done everything that we are to do by church or by the Bible, but we don't want to have any involvement by the state, or we don't want to marry just because it's a utilitaristic thing, because we get cheaper taxes and so on. But we just promised each other this, but this is not a decision that where anyone else should be involved. It's just our decision.
Yes, and that shows you how selfish people are living in families. It's very great selfishness. It's not the biblical view of the family at all. On the wedding day, it meant to me a great deal that I handed my daughter to someone who wanted to be a trustworthy husband. So, okay, if they don't want to go through the civil service, why didn't they go through religious service? Because it means a great deal. I learned in Asia, marriage is just not about two people getting married.
I think the problem with this couple, which I'm thinking of right now, is that the parents are divorced and they do not have a good relationship to them.
Yeah, okay. But that's a deeper pastoral problem then, isn't it? Because you've got to deal with that issue for the whole family. The issue of the effect of divorce on two people, the reluctance of people to get married. We have people in their 30s, etc., who really want to, but they're reluctant to take the step because of that. Okay? So I think it's sort of still the public, the issue of the, that it has always been a public occasion. And even if you don't want the state to do it, you ought to do it. But if you don't deal with the underlying problem, we're just living together because the family was difficult, etc., that's not the way to deal with people's past, I don't think. That's my feeling of it anyway, okay?
Is there a public feeling because of the Genesis 2 leaving the world?
Well, I think all societies have recognized that it's, you know, that one wants some occasion, and because it's such a joyful occasion, the Jews spent 3 days doing it, you know, that there's such a joyful occasion that it's a whole family thing. And I learned in Asia, you know, you don't think selfishly. You think about, well, there's the parents and the grandparents and all these sorts of things, and you want to celebrate this event. So, I mean, almost all societies have operated on that basis by almost, I wouldn't say by instinct, because all families takes its cue from God, according to the Ephesian passage, you see. So, yeah, so in that case, we've got to sort of think, but it seems to me that at least there's parts of the 1 Corinthians passage which helps us pull in certain things we know about the marriage context. The situation is different from the ones being dealt here, but does tell you to some extent how you should handle that issue. The fundamental mistake is they believe that marriage is for having children, and that's not what the Bible teaches at all.
That's the cultural side.
And we've got to win over the cultural side.
Side, you can just
yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, the modern side backs up the cultural view to some extent until you have children. Okay, so we've dealt with the sexual issue completely. Is that right? Well, then let's ask ourselves very briefly, how does Paul deal with that? But let's just run through the 1 Corinthians 15 passage again, okay? It's very interesting that Paul goes right back to the beginning, okay, on this issue. Because where does he start? He starts about the nature of the gospel that he's preached to them, and he indicates that the gospel is something that God has promised beforehand, because remember, in the Bible, if it isn't predicted, it probably isn't true. Okay? Because God does nothing but first, he tells his servants, the prophets. He always gives an early press release what he's doing. Okay, Amos 3, verse 8. God does nothing but first he tells his servants, the prophets. That's the nature of God. So the fact that the resurrection of Christ has been, that Scripture bears witness to it, is what we would expect, given the character of God. Okay? And we all know that what is of great importance, Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures. He rose again, raised from the dead on the third day, in accordance with the Scriptures. Okay? Then there was the proof of the resurrection being seen alive by some. And then I was a Johnny come lately in verse 8. And last of all, as one who was sort of late arriving in this world, untimely born, he appeared to me also. I am least of all the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace wasn't in vain. On the contrary, I slave my guts out more than any of them, he says, that I might bring the gospel to you. Not I, but the grace of God within me. So whether I, it's whether or they, people put themselves out to bring the gospel. That seems to me to be the end of the discussion at that point. Okay? Because verse 3 is connected with, they've all got connected through, and it's, we come then to the end of that first section, where Paul is trying to put before them the fact that he saw the Christian life as one way he exercised his responsibilities in the gospel. Okay? How can some say there's no resurrection of the dead? Now, we use the word dead. The word dead bodies can be just as much used in this issue if you wanted to in the translation. But Paul goes on to produce a set of arguments. If there's no resurrection of the body, and there's no resurrection of Christ, there's no resurrection of the body, then we have no hope. We are sort of pathetic people. But the fact is, Christ has been raised from the dead, and the discussion that goes on there, what's going to happen? And then Paul raises the question, otherwise, what does it mean to be baptized on behalf of dead bodies? If the dead are not raised at all, why are people baptized on their behalf? Why am I in danger every hour? Paul goes on to say, I fought the beasts at Ephesus. I die every day. What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought the wild beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. Do not be deceived, the command is. Bad company corrupts good morals, the first injunction. And the second one is, wake out of drunkenness. Stop sinning, for some do not have the knowledge of God. Now, why is Paul saying, wake out of drunkenness or stop sinning? What sinning are they doing? And what is it connected with drunkenness and things like that? Okay? So my argument is, in this opening section, that Paul is laying the foundation to tackle this major cultural issue about the fact it doesn't matter what you do in the body. John Brown's body may lie moulding in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. And that was the first century view of the immortality of the soul. Everyone believed, except the Sadducees, in the immortality of the soul. And also, when the emperor died, you had the apotheosis, the emperor, where he went up to heaven and you issued little cameos and sold them all around the empire, celebrating the death of the emperor, in which he's travelling up to heaven on a cloud with certain people with him. Okay? That's what people believed. But it seems to me that Paul is saying something very different. And one of the problems I have about this interpretation, please account for this as to why it's there. it doesn't seem to be part of the argument for some people if it's simply a discussion about the resurrection. Okay? That's my feeling. I want to know why the commands, do not be deceived, wake up. And the implication is that I fought with the beast at Ephesus, metaphorically speaking. That means sexual passion. If you read the writers of the first century, it doesn't say that Paul literally fought with the beast. It says kataranthropon in the Greek, meaning figuratively speaking. So Paul himself recognizes when he's in Ephesus that Paul may have the gift of singleness, but doesn't mean to say that, like us all, the issue of sexuality is not sort of a temptation. In chapter 9, he says, I discipline my body, and I bring it under subjection. And here Paul dies, he says, every day. If you don't accept that invitation, that interpretation, you certainly have to say, fighting the beast at Ephesus. Says that Paul is quite open with the congregation, that there were sexual struggles for him. Not the sort of thing that pastors would share with their church today, but Paul seemed to be quite comfortable in telling the Corinthians that. Okay? And reminding them from the Menander Thrace, a very famous play, and a very famous statement, bad company corrupts good morals, ruins good people. And it's to do with sex. And then we come on to the business about eating, drinking, wake out of drunkenness, stop sinning, because the task of every Christian is to share the gospel. Paul's made that clear in 11 verse 1. At the end of 10, every Christian must share the gospel with other Christians. We don't think that's the case. We pay people now to do it so we can get on with making money and doing other things, but Paul is quite clear. The task of every Christian is to share the gospel to their own disadvantage. And these people are not prepared to disadvantage them in any way, but to become self-indulgent. Okay? I know some of you look a bit stunned, but seem to me to be quite a natural interpretation. Okay? Then we go on to the business. They say, well, the cynics say, and here Paul is answering the questions and the objections that people raise. He knows what they're going to say. He knows what they are saying. Some of you will ask, you foolish people, verse 36. Okay? And he goes on to give a statement there about the nature and the victory and where the future of the Christian lies. Death, where is your sting? Grave, where is your victory? And then the ethical implications. So at the end of chapter 11, end of chapter 14, Paul uses the verb hosteia. It's a connection in Greek and indicates that he is spelling out the implications of his arguments in the last verse. So he says, therefore, these are the ethical injunctions. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding, not in your indulgent life, but in the work of the Lord, knowing that your work in the Lord will not be in vain. It's something that will last forever. And Paul, later on, of course, is going to say that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the good or the evil done in the body. All of us must, including Christians. And just as today that's something that is completely lost, so it is that I think it's, 2 Corinthians 5? I've lost it. But it's there anyway. Okay? That's right. Verse 10, it is necessary that all of us must appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Okay? So that is Paul's doctrine of the Christian life. So what I'm saying is that once you realize that, once you realize the business about that where the Christian's priority is to be, you can see it seemed to my mind that Paul has dealt with this question of the attitude of the body and the future of it. And the fact is that Christians must stop sinning. In what area? In this whole area. So I see Paul here dealing with, as I said, the immediate issues and then coming on to deal with the final issue, the underlying cause in regard to this question of immorality on the part of the Corinthians. Now, that's not the normal way that we treat the text, but seems to me to be a pastorally good approach with people, to deal with immediate problems, but to recognize in the case of the people in the culture from 1820s onward, that we need to deal with that cultural issue, because if we don't, it will continue on and on and on. And therefore it needs to be tackled in the same way that the issue of sexual immorality in a world in which it's now regarded as it's okay, practice safe sex, all those sorts of things, and young people are bombarded with that world. And what steps have we taken to actually indicate to people that this is unacceptable? It's not a case of true love waits. That's ridiculous, telling young people that. You need bigger arguments than that, that true love waits. Because in some cases, they do everything else except penetrate before they get married, without being too crude about the sort of things that are happening in some of the scenes amongst young Christian people. But we need to put in the sort of argument that Paul does. So my feeling is that there are a number of very important things that, as a pastor, I learned from 1 Corinthians as to how I should handle cases. So in the case of the young man who's an actor in Hollywood, become involved in, has been to a theological college, goes to Hollywood to be an actor, becomes involved in sexual activities, he knows a wrong as a Christian, but is involved in that sort of thing. He comes, in the end, his world begins to fall apart, and he comes and he asks me, he wants to talk to me about this issue. So what do we deal with? The immediate issues. But also I recognize that underneath there is a much bigger issue for him. Pastorally, let's deal with the emergency thing. Let's deal with the immediate issues. Okay, take your name off the gay website. Okay? He rang up and apologized to all the men he'd been involved with sexually and said as a Christian he should not have done it. Changed his telephone number. He did a whole stack of things. And we began to get him to, in the point in dealing with him, he's a nice guy, dealing with these issues in terms of repentance. And I've never heard anyone cry so much in prayer to God for what his life had been in the last 5 years. There was real repentance. But that's not the end. Underneath, there is a bigger issue for him. And can we deal with the big issue about, well, I want to be successful. I want to be great. I'm American. I can't be president, but I'd like to be something wonderful. And that is part of the cultural business that underlies that, together with the view that the personal pursuit of happiness is the right of every American citizen. So, okay, that has to be dealt with. But not, you can't deal with that immediately when you've got a first aid situation going. But that seems to me to be a helpful way. I've rung him up every day for the last month, couple of months, and working through some of these issues to how he's going, promised to pray, I've done all those things, and wanting to support and encourage him through this process. But we had to deal with what was a bigger issue underneath. And often in our pastoring and teaching, we fail to take, as it were, the leaf out of Paul's letter to the Corinthians and the way that God acts, that God wants to deal sometimes with the big causes that underlie the issue that actually is promoting a particular attitude. You're going to ask a question? No. Okay. So I found this very helpful. I don't know about other people, but I found it a very helpful way to deal with an issue. He knew, when we read through the passage about not to be deceived, that those who engage in homosexual activity or heterosexual activity have no inheritance in the kingdom. But that wasn't the full stop. There's much more that rests underneath there. And so how are we going to help someone through that sort of process to break with their past, which is absolutely critical on his part, and some of the underlying causes, sexually molested at age 19, horrified, fled, but that left a scar in his own thinking, father died, a whole stack of things that we go through. But there's still a big underlying cause in helping. Honestly, I think that to me is a good way to deal with issues. So let's tackle always and ask, what do we have to demolish? What citadel do we have to get rid of? The cultural citadels are very difficult to deal with, but they need to be tackled. Here the issue of the whole question of who am I and my body, and we need, as it were, to demolish that sort of thinking that's wrong, so that we can bring this person in obedience to the feet of Christ, that now he will take Christ's advice and not simply be moulded by the cultural context. And that's what I see Paul doing on a number of occasions in his letters. He's got to pull down that citadel that everyone sees as a given in the culture. And only by pulling that down, every argument, every high thought that rises contrary to the knowledge of God, everyone's doing it, everything is permitted for me, all those things ingrained in people's minds, that has to be demolished. And when that's demolished, we can bring people and their mind to the feet of Christ, where his instructions are normative, and they will take his advice. But if we haven't dealt with the issue of the pursuit of pleasure, all those sorts of things, then the Christian's going to be, we haven't dealt with the problem. So the mind, we need to tackle the big things that underlie issues. Do we want to have a short break? And then for a couple of minutes, when do we finish this? 5 o'clock, is it? 4:30.
5:30,
14 minutes. Wow, I think we all need a break. We don't have any air conditioning going. Can we get the air? Don't ask me. Do you know how to get it going? The man who gets the vision gets the job. And let's have a 10-minute break, okay? We come back at 4:25, okay? So it's 5. We only got 15 minutes. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, I'm very sorry. Okay. I haven't been sleeping properly. Well, let's then deal with this last issue about the question of conflict. Okay? Okay. Yes.
I have a question for the subject we discussed now. In my pastoral contacts, I am also to tell people with these problems if they ask God for them to give their testimony about forgiveness. But we met here in this text the question the church is able to judge people. Inside.
Mm-hmm.
And probably my question is if there is somewhere danger that we are too quickly to speak people about forgiveness.
No, if you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 2, where the person is repentant, what are the three things the church is to do? Show grace, forgiveness, encourage the person, and reaffirm their love. So you've got to read on in into 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 2, the person is repentant, so what do? The church stands distant from them? No. So the question is, yes, something has to happen, but the point is, every Christian must know that if they are repentant for their sin, in true repentance, that the church itself must do these three things: show grace or forgiveness, encourage the person, and reaffirm their love. Why? Because Paul said, we are aware of Satan's devices, but the contemporary church isn't. They leave people who've been forgiven often feeling that they're not forgiven because the church fails to demonstrate the gospel of forgiveness. So the 2 Corinthians 2 passage, I think, probably touches the issue that we need to remember. That is also at the back of it. Okay. Now, the last one, you're going to give me 5 minutes before you hand those things around? People only take 5 minutes to fill them out.
Yeah, we got 5 minutes.
Okay, we've got more than that. It's now 5:15. We've got to finish at 5:30. That's right? Good. I'm very sorry to be so phased out. On the question of teachers, Paul says, 1 Corinthians 4:6, that they are playing one teacher off against another, Apollos and himself. And if you go through the issue is... that what happens in the ancient world is the followers of teachers are called disciples. They give exclusive loyalty to one teacher and they criticize the disciples of other teachers and they criticize the teachers. That's the secular world of the first century. I belong to Paul, I belong to Apollos. Okay? So there are people who, and I belong to Peter, people sort of saying, well, they are behaving because the disciples of the teachers... The same word is used for the disciples of Christ. So people have read that context in. And we don't have a chance to go through it, I'm sorry. But on the question of the teachers, there is conflict over teachers. 1 Corinthians 3:3, there is strife and jealousy. One says, I belong to Paul, the other says, I belong to Apollos. Paul says, you're behaving like ruddy pagans. You're behaving in a very secular way, Kataranthropon. So there's conflict over teachers in the sense of giving loyalty to this one and not having to do with the other one. And that is typical of what happens in the educational scene. In the courts, we've seen in civil litigation, the same thing happens. There are conventions by which you conduct conflict and seek to have revenge in terms of conflict relationships. At the Lord's Supper, what is happening? That there, I hear there are divisions among you. And I believe that, Paul says. Because when it comes to the Lord's Supper, the divisions that existed in the church and between Christians manifest itself in the supper context. And also spiritual gifts. 1 Corinthians 11, 12, 25. The same thing is happening there. But there are divisions, Paul says. And this is just typical of what happens in the ancient world. And it's also typical what happens in church. If you have a conflict relationship with this guy, he and I are in conflict. And we don't like each other and we fought over issues. Wherever we meet together, there is no unity of the spirit amongst the brothers. And so in every relationship, if he's marking his exam paper and I cut him down to size, okay, because there's revenge in my part. So we're in a conflict context. And that was the nature of the first century society. Quickly, how does Paul resolve this issue? In a very interesting way, which is often overlooked, right at the end, in 1 Corinthians 16, in verse 12, he says, "Now concerning our brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but for him he would not do it. It was not his will to come now." Then verse 13 carries on. "Be watchful, firm, act like men, be strong, let all you don't down in love. And brothers, I urge you," you know the house of Stephanus. What happened there? They're the first converts of Achaia, but they have devoted themselves to the service of the saints. Now that is off the planet in the first century. The word is not the household of Stephanus. It should be the house of Stephanus, meaning the leaders of that house. Okay? Not that if you've got the house of Stephanus, that's right. It is the word for the family, not just the building. But the top people in the house of Stephanus have put themselves in a servile position to minister to the saints. Now, the heads of houses didn't do that sort of thing in the ancient world. This is disturbing the Roman order. And what else is said about it? It says, "Be subject to such as these, and to every fellow worker in labor." So what Paul is saying in a very simple solution is that when the man at the top takes a servile position, everything changes. We heard about that in Philippians 2. When the man at the top takes a servile position, that throws the whole order of conflict out. And I'm sorry I don't have time to deal with that at any length. But in talking to another person who's an ancient historian, Professor Judge, we had a long talk about this. And because here is a way in which you are the heads of houses who take positions, you have to take account of who they are in the ancient world. They conduct all the conflict situations. What happens when they put a towel around themselves and start washing the feet of other Christians? It throws the whole order out. And that seems to me one of the resolutions that comes for this whole problem of conflict. And Paul leaves this to the last, actually. Paul often leaves the final semtext to the last in his letters, does it in Philippians 4, does it here in this one as well, answering the question they've raised now concerning Apollos. We want him back because he's better than Paul. Well, I put some, this afternoon, some starting things before. You've got a couple more minutes in case people want to ask questions. Otherwise, it's not quite at the marriage service. I'll be around for the next couple of days and you may want to raise questions. But I put in a totally different approach to the question of Corinthians. I'm aware of that. Some of you look absolutely stunned, which is good. But I'd be interested in feedback because I'm interested in how do we resolve pastoral issues. It still is a problem. And lots of pastors don't want to tackle the issues, which is very unhelpful. But how are we going to resolve the issues of people and the root causes, not just the symptoms? Symptoms must be dealt with, but also root causes for some of the issues. And my question is, what are the things in your culture which ultimately are causing major problems for the Christian church? And how are you going to resolve those issues? Because we all have things from our culture which are the causes of great difficulties for Christians. And is culture going to win over the Bible? It must not. if we're not going, if we're going to avoid creating culture Christians, people who just simply behave in a cultural way and there's nothing distinctive about their lifestyle. Okay? Any questions? I know that our man is desperate to get out and get the survey done. Okay. Well, I'm glad I've answered all your questions to your complete satisfaction. But if you want to talk to me privately, we can do that later. But thank you very much. Okay? Good.